Welcome to the Profitable Steward Podcast with Jared Sorensen. In this series, we'll learn and explore regenerative agriculture principles. Through practices that improve soil health, animal health, and good stewardship, we are working to help you increase your productivity and profitability. Join us in learning from successful farm and ranch experts who share stories of growth from their fields to help your fields grow strong. Here is your host, Jared Sorensen.
Everyone, welcome to this edition of the Profitable Regeneration Webinar Series. We are pleased to have Eunice Williams here with us and Tina and Richard in the background making sure that everything functions right. If this is your first exposure to what we do here at Ag Steward, we do these twice a month, except for this month. We actually had three this month to accommodate Will Harris. The recordings will go out on podcast channels. It's called the Profitable Steward Podcast, and then our YouTube. So if you've subscribed to this, you'll get the information. As soon as it gets edited up, we'll put it out. And I usually recommend to watch it on YouTube because then you get more of the whole picture. If people share slides or diagrams, in this case, it's probably just going to be more dialogue, which is just fine. We're going to roll with that. So I've asked Art from Canada, if he would be willing to give us a prayer to start this thing. Art, are you there?
Almighty God, in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Christ, we come before you once again tonight. We want to thank you and praise you, Father, for life, and then life more abundantly through your precious Son, Jesus Christ. Lord, the privilege of being on the land, working with livestock, is just an incredible life, Father God. As we share with, as Eunice shares with us tonight, Lord, that you would just help us to pay attention. Lord, what her husband Bud taught us has been incredible. It's changed so many of our lives and benefited our animals. We're just so grateful to you for that. So may we be attentive. Help us to be. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Art. I appreciate you being willing to do that. Very kind of you. And so again, welcome everyone. We are grateful to have Eunice Williams here with us. I got to know Bud and Eunice. I think it was in 2003. I attended a stockmanship school that was put on at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. And I shared this in our class that we had last week. When I sat down with Bud for lunch, he had shattered so many of my paradigms, I felt like I didn't even know which way was up. And I sat there and I listened to his stories and I appreciated being there with him. And I wanted to ask questions, but I didn't feel like I knew enough to even ask a halfway educated question. Because he had taken things that I had adopted for years, like, you know, you could blame the cow, you could blame your horses, you could blame your help. And he had kind of shattered all that. And he said, no, you need to take complete and 100% responsibility for the outcomes that you see. And there are still many things that I remember from that first class that I attended now nearly 22 years ago. And I thought I knew a lot about stockmanship. I mean, we thought we were kind of handy cowboys. We could load cattle out on the desert without corrals and we could do things, but sometimes it worked and sometimes it wasn't. And one of the things that Bud asked me, you know, we would trail cattle, baby calves along ways, and about 80 or 90% of them would get there and things would be good. But there was always the 10% that got unpaired. And one of the things I remembered is Bud asking, are you satisfied with 90%? And I thought, well, I just thought that's how it had to be. You know, if you got 90% of them there, you're doing good. You should see the days when we're not doing good and we have to start all over. And there's been plenty of those days. I think it's maybe Whit Hibbert or one of his crew said, you know, some days you have a Bud Williams day and some days you have a Bud Light day. We don't drink. So, but there were many, many days that things still don't go perfectly. And there have been times when I have stopped and I have asked, what would Bud do in this situation? And what am I doing wrong? And I longed for the ability to be able to call him and to be able to ask him. But although he's not here, there are many who have carried on that legacy, and we're grateful for the work that Bud and Eunice and their family have done to be able to perpetuate good stockmanship, good livestock management. And I think Eunice, you and Bud were rated as like the top 10 livestock influencers at one point. Is that right? Am I thinking that right in Beef Magazine?
Well, we were in the top 50, and I don't think they had them ranked in such a way, but they all, that there was another one.
That was a smaller group, but I forget exactly what, but yeah, they were right up there with barbed wire and refrigeration.
Yeah. Listed in the top 10 innovations in the livestock.
Well, Sylvester.
So,
yeah.
That made us feel pretty good.
Well,
Bud's goal wasn't to impress people, but the whole idea was to make things easier on the cattle. Just the fact that it helped the rancher be more productive was just a byproduct. You know, when we went to work on some of the old time, quote, cowboy ranches, and Bud said, "No way I can handle stock this way." So,
Let's kind of kick it off, Eunice, and maybe if you want to, we don't necessarily need to go chronologically, but if there are highlights that you have from your earlier days in marriage and kind of what started Bud down the path to learning stockmanship. And then we can talk a little bit about the marketing side, and we'll open it up for questions. And this is going to be pretty informal. And we'll just kind of let it roll where it needs to go.
Oh boy, this is what I don't like when you say, "Here it is."
So
okay.
Just
we
start at the beginning, and you've got a book too, so everybody should go read your book. But
actually it pretty well chronicles everything that we have done. We really enjoy the Aleutian Islands. You know, when you come right down to it, once our kids, Tina was in our youngest, she was in her second year of college, and Bud decided that we need to get away from people. He wound up with quite a few people depending on him a little more than he felt comfortable. And he's finally, this one person in particular, he said, you know, because he just kept expanding and getting bigger and bigger. And Bud said, you know, "John's already bigger than he can handle. And if I don't leave pretty soon, I'm going to be stuck with him for the rest of my life." So we just wrote to the Department of Agriculture in Alaska and asked what was going on out in the Aleutian Islands and who was ranching out there. And I just wrote to a few of the ranchers, and all he wanted was a simple ranch job. He said, "Don't tell anybody I know anything. I just need to go someplace where I can get my head together." So it turned out to be quite an adventure. So his simple ranch job lasted until we had a bunch of cattle gathered on an island that they were going to barge them off, and the boss had tried to get these cattle in the corral and couldn't make it. We come in one day and he's sitting with his head in his hands, and he said, "Every penny I've got's tied up in this venture, and there's no way we're going to be able to get these cattle on the barge." So I said, "Well, if you'll do exactly what I say, we'll get the cattle on the barge." So that was the end of Bud's simple ranch job with no responsibilities.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that experience. How you had a pretty young family, I guess. And
No. That was after Tina. Our youngest daughter was in her second year of college by then.
You know, oh, really? It was okay.
So we said, "Okay, we're up until then. We pretty well headquartered right around Northern California, around Eureka, and Tina was actually able to finish all high school in one school. Of course, she had
two schools,
high school, two in high school.
Yeah.
Oh, did you? Well, see, I learned something today. By then, because when Bud always worked on projects, he never really took a job with anybody. You know, they'd have something that that they needed to do, and we just moved there until the project got taken care of. And at that point, he was never tried to teach other people how to do things. He say, "You get everybody out of here in unison. I'll fix your problem, and then we'll bring the crew in and show them how to keep it that way." But we didn't try to do any teaching, and so quite often Tina would spend periods of time staying with neighbors in order to go to school. So,
Okay.
which is why I've kind of forgotten that she had stayed in one school.
Yeah. So how long were you in on the Aleutian Islands?
We were there for about 7 or 8 months, and the fellow that we were working with was way over his head. And he was at that point, he wasn't paying his bills, and but didn't want to get his name tied with him, so we did leave there. Though we were the Alaska, in fact, I think still the Alaskan government is would love to get something going, agriculture going out in that country, but there just aren't that many people that are capable of handling, a ranch where you're not. And of course, at the time we were there, it was in the late 70s, and so now you've got cell phones and all that sort of thing. But back in the some of the soldiers and sailors in that country during the Second World War, that were agriculture boys, they knew what the conditions were, and they actually had some really good ranches going. But then, by the time we were there in the 1970s, it was those people had retired, and the new people coming out, they couldn't, they're used to going to town every month or two. That really wasn't economically feasible back then. So.
Yeah. And so what was your what were you hired to do there? Just kind of for some context for people that don't know the story.
Well, this there's a we're islands, and in fact, there's still islands that have abandoned cattle on them. And the this fellow had bought they had put 35 Herefords and 35 Scottish Highlanders on an island it was about a 2 day barge trip from Umnak, which is where we were headquartered, and they had a slaughterhouse there. So we bought the or this fellow bought the cattle on Semyonov, and in the 20 years that those Herefords and Highlanders had been abandoned, there was now over 700 head of cattle. It was
Wow.
a BLM permit that they had, like 300 head permit, and BLM was really on their neck to get them off, and so that's what we went in to do. And most people do not know what wild cattle are. The people down here that have wild cattle, they're spoiled cattle. They've learned to get away from, these cattle had never seen anything they were afraid of. There was a little gray fox about the size of a house cat, and bald eagles on the island. Now, those are the only two predators. And
Really, huh?
these cattle had never seen anything they were afraid of, and they sure as heck weren't afraid of us.
Interesting.
It was we had there were some old horses left there that were about 25 years old. Like I say, this island was abandoned about 25 years ago, and it was a school teacher in Anchorage that actually bought the permit 20 years ago, and he just hadn't done anything with the cattle.
Okay, yeah.
And the like though if you did things right, if you follow the principles that we taught in our schools, in other words, you don't move directly at them, you don't do anything to try to scare them away, you strictly use your position and pressure release to get animals to move from you, and you don't try to scare them away. And I'll tell you, those Highland Cross cattle, they the horns on them would put a Texas Longhorn to shame.
Really, huh?
Oh my gosh, yes. We were bringing in, well, another thing that made it interesting, of course, these cattle have never, since they've never had anything done with them, you wind up with about 60% bulls in a herd. So you and of course they're just dying of old age, and most people have never handled a herd of animals like that. You know, most people have never seen a bull that's 10 years old unless he's one that stood in the corral all of his life. Mm-hmm. And some of these old fellows, they had to mind of their own. I know we brought in, we were bringing in this one bunch of cattle, and a stray bull joined the herd. And normally, this was in May, and that time of year, the bulls were, you know, the cows were coming in heat, and the bulls were pretty did a lot of fighting anyway. And we did learn that you did not mix two family groups, because that just started a terrible bullfight. You know, when you'd find 25 or 30 head that ran together, you could bring them in. But if you tried to mix two of those groups, well, it was a terrible bullfight. And but we had one strange bull joined the bunch when we were bringing this little bunch of cattle in, and it was just like you'd almost hear the eerie music, like in a movie when the not quite sane person walks in the room and every animal just parted and let him go where he wanted. I mean, he went through the middle of the herd, and nobody challenged him. And Bud came around to myself and this other fellow that was with us and said, no matter what that bull wants to do, you let him do it. If he wants to leave, you let him go. Don't try to stop him. Well, he came along with us for quite a ways and decided to leave. And the other fellow that was with it, he just got over in front of him. He's going to turn him back. And the old guy, he just put his head down and charged the guy on the horse. He got his horse turned, but he couldn't get it going fast enough. And this bull ran along behind that horse and stuck his nose between his mare's hind legs and boosted her hind end off the ground about four times before she ever got her legs going to outrun him. I mean, he had 4-foot wide horns anyway, and never ever tried to hook her. I mean, he could have killed them both so easy, but he just knocked him out of the way and he left. So we let him go.
Yeah. Well, you've got some, from what I remember from the school, some pretty amazing stories of loading those cattle onto the barges and
those particular cattle were no trouble to load once we got things organized. You know, the island had, there was about 1,000 acres island that was just connected by a sandbar to the main island, and that's what we were using for holding pasture, you know, because we'd gather them and waiting for the barge to come back in to load as we put them out there. And that was where we were having, where to begin with, to drive them off of that part of the island up to the corrals when the barge came in that they had the problems with. So it was...
You might tell them how Dad taught them to take pressure.
Oh, yeah. In order to teach these animals to be handled closely, you know, that you need to do to work them in a corral and so on, the first thing he did was we gathered the whole herd up. We probably had 500 or 600 head probably on that part of the island that we're going to load on the barge, and we just drove them all right up against the ocean. You know, just properly, you know, you drive them moving the back and forth, you know, with just the procedure that Bud used to drive cattle, and held them right against the ocean. And what you're doing is teaching them to take pressure. Mm-hmm. And so you would drive, we'd push them close to the someplace where they couldn't go, and you make them feel uncomfortable. as in, and then you back off, and then you go in again until they're feeling uncomfortable, and you back off, and this way you're teaching them to accept, you know, this pressure. And it was so funny because after about half an hour, you started hearing this big commotion, not a real commotion. It was like a really angry beehive in the middle of this herd. And it just they were just kind of moo, moo, moo like this. And about 50 of those old bulls just pulled out, just come marching right towards us. And Bud just told everybody to back off. And he just picked up his position, like, and he was driving him in the direction they wanted to go. They were pulling out of the bunch, and Bud just dropped in along the at the right on the back corner, just like he wanted to drive him that way. And he just drove him that way, and then of course kept changing his position until he had him turned back towards the herd, and they come back into the herd, and then everything pretty well settled down. So then the following morning, we just went out and drove and was able to gather them up without any problem and drive them to the corral. I should say without any problem because, because we I think we've got them in the it was probably 3 or 4 miles at the most, and I don't and we didn't get them in the corral till about 7 o'clock that night. But if you just keep in mind you've got about, oh, 300, about 200 cows. Some of them have baby calves. They're just starting to calve then. You have about 200 old bulls that are the ones that aren't trying to are aren't fighting and chasing the whipped out bull over the top of you. Well, anyway, it was quite a conglomeration when you come right down to it. But we had two dogs. All we had was two dogs, and you just couldn't believe how hard they worked. I mean, the cattle had no respect for a man or a horse. They wouldn't turn for you at all, but they would work. They turned for the dog. You know, they'd never seen dogs before. These weren't particularly good dogs. They were just pickup dogs that we gathered up before we went out there, but they really did a job for us that day.
And so that was kind of representative of a lot of what you did would be called out to do special projects, people that needed help with
Right.
and
Anytime it got down to where it was routine, well, Bud was ready to go find something more interesting. The place you were talking about loading the cattle, though, that was kind of funny because that was this was out in the Aleutians too. The fellow had also leased another island, and the island that we were on, the one with the slaughterhouse, had been operational up till about 5 years before we moved in there. So these cattle, and since there was a slaughterhouse there, the outfit that moved out, they basically slaughtered anything they could get in. So the only thing that was left were the outlaws and their descendants. And these were typical wild cattle. I mean, you know, they could hide from you, swear that country is absolutely flat, and they could no way get out of sight. But boy, they could find a ditch to hunker down in, so you wouldn't go by. But at any rate, he leased this other island that didn't have it w wasn't stocked at all, and so he was going to take cattle from this particular island, which these cattle were mostly Hereford and Charolais. And so we had about, I guess we had about 25 miles to from where we gathered them up to where the barge was that we were going to load these cattle on. And this was a big World War II. It was basically a Navy base, but there was a lot of Army there too. But anyway, they had a lot of they had built bridges over the little streams and so on. But of course, by the late 70s, from 1945. They weren't in very good shape. And Bud and I are bringing these cattle in, and he said, every animal is going to go across every bridge. And I said, well, these little ditches, I mean, these little streams are not that big. We don't need to put them over, you know, through over the bridges. And he said, no, everyone is going to go every bridge. And I didn't even want to ride my horse across them. You know, they didn't look very sturdy. But anyway, when we got to headquarters, they already had the barge tied up. And in this particular place, they really didn't have any beach at all. It just dropped right off. And so you couldn't normally on Semyonov, when we loaded the cattle, you could just run the barge up as close as you could get. And then when the tide goes out, you're sitting right on the beach. But at this place, there was no beach there. It just dropped right off. So we had it tied to an old World War II cat on one side, and on one of the piers that were the posts and was the old pier. Well, they tied to that. Well, every time a wave would come in, that bow gate would raise up about 18 inches and move over about 4 feet, and then the next wave would come in and pick it up and move it over again. Uh-huh. And just relentlessly. And so here's we're coming with the cattle, and no corrals, no panels, no nothing. All and we just pointed those cattle right at the barge, and every time that bow gate would come up, the lead cattle would stop, and as soon as it sat down, they'd hurry to get up before it lifted up again, and it would lift up, and we loaded that whole barge load, never had one animal balk at it. And in later years, someone asked us what was the most difficult thing we'd ever done. And neither Bud or I even thought of that, because really? It wasn't difficult. It was either going to be easy or it was going to be impossible. And we did have them prepared for it. Maybe I better describe the barge. The barge was one of the old World War II landing craft. You know, you've probably seen the war movies, you know, where the barge runs up on the beach and the bow gate falls down and the tanks and troops run off. And that's what we were hauling these cattle on.
And then just how many cattle would fit on a barge?
It was over 100 head.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
So the first
go ahead.
No, I said the first load or two we took off the bulls. I mean, it was a hodgepodge of an operation, because the bulls got to fighting on the barge, and they killed a couple of three, and so they just pulled into one of the uninhabited islands and dumped them all off. We lost two loads of cattle before we actually got a load back into the slaughterhouse. So the next load, when they came out the barge again, we had some dividers put in so we could maneuver some of these troublemaking bulls off by themselves. It was a comedy of errors. There was you had no background of how to do this sort of thing. So.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So when, I guess, how did this whole procedure of working with troubled stock start?
And just being a good neighbor. That was all it was. I was always a dog nut, and Bud liked dogs too. And so between the two of us, we did have good dogs, and anytime people would have trouble getting the cattle in, well, they'd ask Bud to come and help get them in. And it just went from, like I say, just being a good neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty neat. So one, maybe to back up just a little bit, to give some context for who Bud was, and we mentioned before we started this that he was a little bit polarizing, but he probably wired a little different than most people. I remember
he definitely was.
I remember a story when he was put in solitary confinement and he thrived.
Yeah, absolutely. I met Bud's aunt. In fact, it was after Bud died. I met his old aunt, and she had married Bud's uncle. And she said, you know, all those Williams boys were really smart, but she said they were all a little strange. And I said, yeah, that is absolutely right.
Yeah, unique, definitely. And so you were pretty young when you guys got married, right?
Yeah, I was 14 when we got married. Anytime Bud complained about me, I said, well, it's your problem. You raised me.
Yeah.
Turned out the way you wanted. Well, it's your up to you. So.
Yeah. That's and so in the early years you weren't directly involved in ranching. It was other jobs, logging and
no, yeah, that's right. In fact, really what started us on it, I was trying to get Buddy said, you know, how long we really save our money, how long it would be before we could get a ranch and live on a ranch. And he said, well, we don't have to own a ranch, we can get a job on a ranch. So that was that. And of course, when you get rained out in the woods, there's really not much going on in the wintertime in the logging industry. So we went to work on one of the big ranches in Northern California. And of course, you know, Bud's dad was, he had just the ordinary diversified farm. You know, they milked 30 cows, had a couple hundred sheep, had maybe 100 head of beef cows and hogs and turkeys and all that sort of thing. And you know, his dad handled stock well. And you know, I mean, you don't run the milk cows and you don't get any joy out of having problems. You know, it was a farm. It wasn't some of the first ranges we went to work on. They really delighted in getting the young guys in trouble. But we went to work on one of the big mountain ranches there, and both of us absolutely fell in love with the cow dogs, and so really from then on I think probably a good part of what got Bud started learning a lot of this thing is the way a good cow dog works. And I'm not talking about the ones that are working to command. I'm talking about the ones that you say, there's the cows and there's the trail, and we got to take these cows home. You know, you didn't really say anything to them. They knew what they were doing. So,
and he definitely had a lot of persistence. I know a lot of his stories are stories of spending a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Don Otto shared those. Is there one that comes to mind to you where he kind of outlasted everybody and still got the job done?
Oh yeah, well, especially in the Aleutians, we did that because we had the guys off the barge, they're going to come out and help, and all they do is get in the way. And so Bud and I would just stay out and mess around until they got tired and left, and then we could bring people in. So let's see, I had something in mind. I lost it. So it's, yeah. Oh, you know, when you're, he loved Hereford cattle. He said, you know, you can see that old white sheen shining in the dark, you know, in the dark. And the Angus cattle, they're hard to work it after dark. A lot of times after dark, and like I said before, he always said that no cow can get away from him because she doesn't live long enough, and he actually meant that literally.
Yeah,
he would not leave until he got her where he wanted her. So.
Yeah, well, he was great with cattle. I think he was also great with people. I think he had a gift to be able to read people. And certainly, I've shared this story before, but after coming home and practicing stockmanship for a year, I called up, you probably answered the phone, Eunice, and you said, here, talk to Bud, because I was asking questions, and I was pretty down on myself because it had been a less than successful venture in trying to put together two herds of cattle. And I thought, if Bud can do it, well, by golly, we ought to be able to do it. And we're gonna herd these cattle across this mountainside and place them. And you know, we didn't have electric fence, and the boundary fences weren't even fenced. And we weren't very successful at it. And it was a stressful venture for not only me, but also for our help. And so when I called up Bud, I was kind of down on myself, and not blaming him or not blaming the technique, but just kind of blaming myself that I couldn't figure it out. And he stopped me short and he said, "Jared, there's going to be plenty of other people that are going to beat you up. You don't beat up on yourself anymore." And he said, "At least now you know that you're messing up, and now you can learn." So with me, I think he knew that my tendency was maybe to be hard on myself, and so he didn't have to be. But with other people, he could be very direct, and I'm sure.
And as long as he was chewing on you when he was working with you, you knew that he liked you.
Okay.
He wouldn't waste any time on anybody. He'd just walk off and leave them if he didn't think they were trying. But Don Noddle will absolutely tell you that Bud loved to work with Don, because no matter how tough things got or how much he got on her about different things, you know, she'd never quit.
Yeah.
And you know, people say, "Well, I'm just making things worse. I'm going to go to the house." Well, boy, you lost points with him in a hurry there. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when did he start teaching stockmanship schools, and how did that evolve?
Actually, while we were still in Northern California, I mean, he, like I say, he worked on projects. He worked on, but we did work in the same area, and there was a group of ranchers there that just were really high on what he was doing. One particular large animal veterinarian that really, you know, quite often he'd have a client and he'd say, you know, he says, "Your problem isn't drugs." He said, "I don't know that I can help you any more than what I'm doing," but he said, "You should have Bud come out and work with your stock, because he can, you know, if you work animals under a great deal of stress a long time, well, you don't get the production and the results that you'd like to get." And Dr. Douglas absolutely recognized the fact that there's more than just giving them a shot to make things better. And but anyway, at the point what I was trying to make was all of these people that he worked with in that area said, "Bud, you've got to get this documented, teach it to you know, in such a way that it's not going to be lost to you." And they insisted the University of California from Davis to come up and do some and video some things. These ranches said that they would furnish the stock if they whether they could get a grad student or someone to work with them. You know, all Bud wanted to do was document it, because he really did not like to work with people. You know, I don't, you know, people that were really interested and really wanted to learn, he had all the patience in the world with, but as far as just quote people in general, he didn't handle them as well as he could have. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the alumni of UC Davis, the people around there had always really backed and donated a lot of money to the university. So they finally sent up a video crew, and they videoed for 2 or 3 days. By working stock and explaining what he was doing. In fact, then they took that video back and never did a thing with it. And the guys, the ranchers that were involved in all this, they tried to get them to send us the raw footage that they had taken, because they had some really good equipment and, you know, really had some good video. And And they had wound up with about 20 minutes that they'd edited out of something that didn't show anything and it was of any value. But anyway, from that point on, which would have been in what the, oh, in the,
Probably about 75 or
well,
so.
that, yeah, before that, because we left, we went to Alaska in 77. So it was well before that. But really did was trying his best to get it documented. And that, and of course, that increased the stress on him. You know what I'm saying? That's why we went to Alaska. He said, I've got to get out of here because I'm, Bud had a pretty fragile mind. I don't think people really realize what a fragile mind he had. And he just had to get away from it. So, but then it, I guess it was probably, well, it was in 1990 when he did that one afternoon at the Salkman Grass Farmer Grazing Conference. And by that time I had video camera and I videoed all of his talks so he could watch them himself and critique them, you know, learn how to talk better to people and do these things. And after he saw that, he said, you know, it is really all there. He says it's not very fancy, but if I die tomorrow, well, if anybody's really interested, they can still get the information. And so from that point on, he really did relax about the schools. But that's why we wound up in Canada, though, because the owner of VT Feeders, he really wanted us to stay there and headquarter there, and you know, we work out doing schools from there, but. He said, "What would it take to get you to stay and work with me?" And Bud said, "I'd really like to get these schools going." And Bud's problem was he couldn't charge anybody anything. He even he, and he wouldn't let me charge either. Like I say, you know, I mean, this whole thing was just being a good neighbor. And anytime we did go on a job for something, they'd say, well, wait till I get done, you pay me what you think it's worth. And that's the only time he'd ever accept money. He'd never say, you know, no, I'm going to charge you X number of dollars to do something. So anyway, but Richie did a wonderful job. I mean, you know, he set the price. He's the one that talked money with the people, you know, but never had to say you owe me so much for coming to the school. No, they did a good job of getting the schools promoted.
Yeah, and you were probably there about as long as you stayed anywhere at
Yeah,
the meeting.
actually we were. Yeah, we were there almost 11 years. We moved up there in December of 1990 and moved out right on 2000.
Yeah. Yep. And a lot of high risk cattle, a very harsh environment. It was kind of one of
Yeah,
those.
the whole thing was is that they had always been a finishing yard. You know, they buy 900 pounders and finish them. Well, the slaughterhouse in Edmonton, which was in, you know, they're up in the northern part, they're halfway up Alberta. You know, there's no roads if you pull. There's no roads beyond north, but that was north is where the people are. They closed the slaughterhouse down in Edmonton, so they really were at a disadvantage to the feedlots in the southern part of Alberta because that's where the slaughterhouses were. So they wanted to wean calves, put calves in the feedlot, and they like most feedlots even today, it is very difficult to wean calves in the feedlot. They usually have some really high sickness rates. So that was the main reason he really wanted him there, and which is what we did. So.
Well, I know there's probably some questions that people have on corral design and things like that. And what I remember Bud saying is that you just kind of make do with what you have, right?
Oh
You know,
yeah,
he
he
wasn't
never
built for
expected
anyone.
anybody to change facilities, though he sure hated the tubs. And he said, I hope I live long enough to He said, "I don't care if they build what I say, but just build something better than a tub, because they are made to force cattle, and that's and anytime you force animals to do things, you don't get a very good result on it." So, and actually, he actually saw some of the bigger feedlots pull out the tubs and put in bud boxes.
Yeah, and the bud box was just probably something that he created kind of intuitively, and now it's really caught hold and it's kind of the default. But
he knew that if you're trying to put cattle through a gate where a difficult area, that you needed to start from where you wanted them to go. I mean, the animals want to see you, and if you're behind them to make them force them to go forward, they can't see you, so their attention is all on keeping an eye on you behind. They don't even see what's in front of them, and so Bud knew that you needed to start from the entrance to the chute. And as it happened, we work cattle every place, everybody's any time you went, you worked with facilities that they had, and he learned that you could make any facility work. The only thing about a bud box is if it is built to the correct dimensions, it's hard for you to mess it up. You actually have to use your head, otherwise, if it's too wide, you will try to get down behind them. And the whole idea is that you pressure them again, just like we were pressuring those cattle against the ocean. You're pressuring them against a place that they can't go, to where they want to go back the way you want them to go. And so when we got to this one place, and it was really a terrible situation, and Bud always pinned the cattle, and it was one that everybody said it was just almost impossible to get the cattle into that. Well, so all he would just finally he just shut the gate on them, and then he walked up to the front and worked them just like it teaches to work a bud box now. And it just worked so great. So all you had to do is just bring your cattle in the opposite direction. And then that was the beginning of the bud box right there. He was just
okay.
Trying to make a really unpleasant. It was just a square pin with just a chute sticking out the side of it. And of course, if you get behind him trying to shove him into something like that, it was pretty tough. And
Yeah, well, it's sure neat to see how that has kind of caught fire in the industry. And once people see it work, it seems like people are hooked, probably because we've all been on that trying to force cattle. And so when you just see it work and it's smooth, it's like it.
Yeah.
You're sold.
It is. Let's see here again. I've lost my train of thought. I guess it wasn't all that important.
It's all right.
Forget about that.
we'll open it up here for questions here in a minute.
I know what I was. I really do want to say this. Yes, I remembered. Watched a lot of YouTube videos of people showing how to use a bud box, and very, very, very few of them are doing it right. The whole idea is that you can just tell that these are people are trying, instead of pressuring the animals against the back end and making them want to come by, they're trying their best to get around behind them. They always walk down the side. They're trying to get behind them. But if it's built properly, oftentimes the cattle are going into the single file before they can get to the wrong place. if it's built a little bit too wide, well, they're able to get behind the cattle, and then it doesn't work very well. But if it's not any wider than about 16 feet, well, usually that's enough pressure that the animals will be going up the chute in spite of them, not because they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. When it's built right and you do it halfway right, it does work. And so, would you consider your type of cattle working as low stress? It's kind of a trick question, but
well, it kind of got started that way. The people we worked with, they called it that, And it is. I mean, you know, we come right down to there's certainly low stress on the people because you don't. I haven't been yelled at a whole lot in my life, even though you'd think I had. In fact, every once in a while, when we're working with other people, I'd after we through, I said, "But do you really think it was necessary for you to holler at me over this?" And he said, "Well, I've been chewing on Dalton Nudge all day, and I didn't know how much more he could take. So if I scolded you for it, well, maybe he'd pick up on it and learn something." So.
We'll switch gears here just a little bit and then open it up for question and answers from the audience. And I haven't seen any in the chat yet, but what about the marketing side? If you know, it's still something that Richard and Tina, you guys teach, and kind of the Bud Williams sell by marketing principles. How did that come about?
Well, he, you know, you can't be out chasing cows all the time, and he had to have something to do. But
Okay.
no, he really liked to figure things out, and even way back long time ago, he's figuring out that you can't afford to feed hay, and why not let the cows eat it and figure out. Well, there's one particular time. He was driving out with this fellow, and they fed to have about 22 head of cows off in this area. And they had cattle scattered, you know, a lot of cattle, and it was a bottom land kind of a place. And Bud drove out with him, and he sat there figuring with a pencil and paper. And he said, "John, when you come out to feed those cows tomorrow," he said, "you better bring a rifle out and just shoot them all." And which he said those kind of things. You got to get their attention before he. And he f showed him on paper that he had going to have more money into those 20 head of cows that you're driving out every day to feed than they're going to be worth. And of course, it didn't take him long to get a truck out there and haul and put them with some other cattle that it wasn't going to be that easy. No, he did. He figured all the time. I mean, he always was always figuring on things. And he said it doesn't help anybody to show them how to handle their cattle and get more out of their cattle. But he said if they go broke by the way they're marketing, I'm not really helping them much. So that's. But he had a strange mind, you know. He saw things that other people didn't. We were at this ranch one time. This guy had a white cat and had one little black spot on top of its head. And he's the guy said, "I bet you have never seen an all white cat with just one little black spot on it." And Bud said, "What makes you think that isn't a black cat with a great big white spot on it?" And to me, you know, to me that just typified Bud's thinking, is he never saw anything the way other people did.
Yeah, that's so
But
interesting.
anyway, that was kind of the thing. And he had a lot of problems with his stomach. At one time, I suppose he had ulcers, but he'd never go to a doctor. So anyway, this friend of ours was invested in the stock market, and he kind of got Bud interested in the stock market, and he could kind of, which I would think would be hard on somebody that had a nervous stomach, but then he could get so wrapped up in that. Well, then he got interested in the commodity market, and of course the way he traded commodities was basically the same way he taught to work to sell and buy livestock, which I'm not sure which came first, whether it was the livestock first that you're working spreads. In other words, you know, when he was working in the commodity market, he might spread between wheat and oats or different months of different commodities, and he didn't care whether they went up or down. He just knew that the spread between the two was illogical. That at some time before these contracts expired, that they were going to come together to a more logical rate of what they should be, and that's basically what he does with the cattle. I mean, you know, if the difference between heifers and steers gets too far apart, you know they're not going to stay that way, and you don't really care whether you go up or down, and that's basically the basis for the marketing, but.
It's definitely, he's got, as a maybe a different approach to a lot of things that he viewed in life. And
Oh yeah, I mean it nothing was sacred to him as far as, one thing is really bad working with cowboys because, it is really, really the height of ill-mannered for one cowboy to ride in front of another in between them and the herd of cows. But if you've got the angle and the cattle are moving for you, well, he encouraged people to do that. So
Well, there's a more technical question here about parking or placing animals. Any thoughts there that you guys have? Just I know that was one of the skills that Bud would talk about in his stockmanship classes, is being able to place cattle
Right.
without fences and have that be a comfortable place for them to stay and to come back to. And
Right.
he said he never built a foot of fence for grazing purposes, but yet I would say was a pretty good grazer from what all
Yeah. And
accounts are so.
you get into something really weird. As far as I'm concerned, cattle, and I've never seen any cattle, period. That are livestock that really feel that comfortable, that safe in their environment. They are a prey animal, and it's their mindset, and they got to keep track of everything. Bud could put cattle in a pen. We were at Browns Valley, California. They wanted Bud to put on a demonstration, and they had about 20 head of heifers, I guess, in this field. It was over 100 degrees. They had two really nice groves of trees, and when we drove up, they said, "Well, what facilities do you want to show this demonstration?" And Bud said, "Anything that a normal rancher would do." Well, we drive up, and here's his pen sitting right out in the middle of the field. That's three panels one way and two panels the other way, a 6 foot gate going into right square out in the middle of the field. And we drove up, and I said, "Bud, let's go home. There's no sense for, people. They're just trying to find something you can't do." And of course he said, "Oh, now, mommy, that's all right." So anyway, he worked with these heifers for maybe half an hour or so. And drove them up to the pen, and then he called the guy out that had set this up. He said, "Now you come out and put them in." And Roger said, "Well, I can't do that." And Bud said, "Yeah, you can, because I'll tell you." And so Bud basically told him every step to make, and he puts them all in this little pen. And they're quite happy to stand there. You're not going to get them in there unless they wanted to go in. So we all left for lunch. And one of the guys that finished eating lunch, he walked back up, and he said they were all still standing right out in the sun, 100-degree day. And two of them had stepped out of the pen. And he said, as soon as he saw me coming, he said they stepped back into the pen. And then it was about 4 hours later, I guess, that we drove out of there, and they were still standing in the pen. And I don't think it's so much, personally, I think that when Bud puts them someplace, they feel so comfortable, they feel so safe there, that that's where they want to be. And because I know we had another place this guy wanted. Was wanting Bud to teach you how to place the cattle, and all they had was a 10-acre field. It was a pie-shaped field, just your normal pie-shaped field with the water at the small end. It was a old alfalfa field that was that the and about oh the top 25% of it, the wide end, was outside of the field. It was just rocky, kind of brushy, and the rest of it was just really nice pasture land. And he wanted Bud to show him how to place cattle on that. And Bud got kind of cranky with him because he said, "You're just making fun of me now. You can't place cattle on 10 acres." But he did. There was a lot of apologizing and no, I want to just no, because I want to learn how to do this. And so they did. They just, like Bud does, puts them in a place. Drive them until you learn to take the pressure off. They have to motion, the movement has to die a natural death. You can't stop it. You don't go in front of them and stop them. You start taking all the pressure off before you get there. You start doing the things that cause animals to not drive for you, which is why most people try to drive animals. You have to kind of understand what these animals are thinking. But when you do get to that point, and if they're comfortable to rest and be pointing in all different directions, then that's when he said, okay, they'll stay. Even if they stop and start grazing, but they're all grazing in the same directions, there's still what you call movement in them. Their mind is still, on moving forward. But anyway, here we were there for we left them on this rocky place, and like I say, this other was lush grass ready to be grazed again. And while we were there, they went to water three different times, walked all across this lush grass, and still went back to that rocky place to spend their day. So to me, that's telling you that there's something a little bit different going on than teaching them anything. I mean, what you're not teaching them anything, you're making giving them a making their mind be comfortable. They say, okay, this is safe, this is comfortable, this is where I want to be. When we were in Canada, in that bush country, and there was about probably 20,000 head of cattle that come out of that country in the wintertime. And Richie wanted to keep his cattle up there about a month longer than when these cattle decide to come home. I mean, they just come home. In fact, most of the people that do have fences up there, they open the gates because they're coming home. And they're a bunch of sissies. I thought those they want to get back to that corral where the hay is. But anyway, Richie had one little area that it was fenced, and it had a pond in it for water. And that particular year, the pond dried up. But he'd saved that to put these cattle in, so when the rest of the cattle out of that country started coming home, that his wouldn't go home with them. And but like I say, when fall came, he put the cattle in that pasture, and there wasn't any water in it, so I had to leave the gate open. And there was about a lake about a mile outside. They'd go through the gate, go about a mile to this lake and drink, and they go back. They went back to that pasture, and I think Richie had about 170 head up there, and I think five actually picked up the migrating cattle, and the rest of them stayed in that pasture until Bud and Richie went up and got them, brought them home. So there's and of course Steve Cody was working with it was Steve, wasn't it, that working with those with the cattle and the BLM lands, and learning how to keep and graze them on the uplands and keep them off the streams. And but it isn't by they tried to make them feel uncomfortable on the streams, and that didn't work at all. But you had to make them feel really comfortable where you wanted them to be. You don't want to try to make them uncomfortable from where you don't want them.
Well, that's good. That's a good answer to that question. And one other question here is, do you recommend loading stock trailers the same way as semis? So kind of using the bud box method, I guess, or is there a better way for loading, a bigger doored stock trailer versus going into
No,
an alley?
no, no, no. You just need the pin big enough that you can put a full compartment in. If you're putting up to a head gate, well, probably 20 feet long is long enough. But if you're going to need like 30, maybe 32 by 16 to fill a full deck of cattle on a truck. But no, I didn't. No, really, no
Same
different at all. I do.
principle.
People think cattle are afraid of they think that they would be afraid of being pinned in there, but you know, really, some of the spookier cattle are easier to load in a trailer out in the country without a corral or anything, just because it is a little hidey hole and they just kind of ducky in there. They don't feel they've been trapped unless you're just charging right after and trying to slam the door on them before they can get out. Well, then you're not going to get even close to it. But if you work them about halfway right, these spookier cattle kind of like going into a little place they can hide.
That's good. So Tina, maybe if you think of a story you want to share, and then we'll respect your time. We'll probably wrap things up here in the next few minutes. But one story that stood out to me was about, maybe you can tell me the context, but Bud said he would come home from work, listen to two ball games on different radios, read the newspaper, and carry on a conversation with you. Is that really true? He could
Yes.
have, that's the way his mind worked, was he could focus on four different things at once.
I do remember him listening to two ball games at once when we were out in the Bald Hills. I do remember that. We didn't have electricity, but so we didn't have TV, but he'd listen to two ball games, and then he could tell you their mother's maiden name too. So
What color their father's eyes were, and so
Any stories that you remember from your growing up with your mom and dad and all your ventures, Tina, that you want to share with this group?
Oh gosh, you know what?
Broken arm
Oh
story.
yeah, probably the best one. I was in high school, and we were this the ranch where Dad was doing that intensive grazing with the 2 to 3,000 head on
378.
378 acres. But
Wow.
so I was helping him work cows one day in the corral, and evidently I was waving my arms. And I'm sure he had told me to quit it a couple of times. And finally he said, "The next time wave your arms, I'm going to break it off." And unbeknownst to either of us, his boss, who owned the cattle, was waiting for the opportune time to come and talk to Dad. He felt that was probably not the opportune time to come talk to Dad. So he left, and he came back a couple hours later, and he said, "Well, Tina," he said, "look like you didn't wave your arms anymore because the stuff broke off." And it's funny because that would have been many years ago. I guess it's probably almost 50 years ago. And if I step into a pen of animals, my hands go in my pockets, or my thumbs go in my belt loop, or in my back pocket. They don't.
You don't stick your hand in
No.
front of a cow's face to
No.
turn her back.
No, that's I learned that really well. But it's important. It was an important thing, and I'm sure it was messing up the work that we were doing, and I just didn't understand the importance of it. But boy, I sure do now.
Well, that's good. Thank you, Tina, for sharing that. I appreciate that. And we had the opportunity to have Don Notto stop by the ranch last fall and spend a day with us. And we had a couple thousand yearlings that we were grazing and trying to get them to use some of our uplands. And so it's neat to see that the legacy continues to live on through many of the people who've gone on to teach schools and give full credit to Bud and Eunice and the good work that they've done. And sometimes put their own twist on it and still, are able to maybe explain it a little bit differently, but it's based on the same principles and ultimately to get the results of what we hope that we can have an environment where families can get along, where it doesn't end up in a yelling match
Oh,
with
yeah.
one of the kids getting mad and stomping off and the mom saying, "To heck with you, I'm out of
Go to
here."
the house.
And the dog wants to leave because he doesn't know who's getting yelled at, but emotions are high and the cattle are stressed. And so and that's not how it has to be, right? You
It
guys
is
have
not.
proven that there's a way that it can work. And go ahead, Eunice, and then I think Art has a question.
Okay. Well, go ahead, Art.
And I'm sorry if I
Eunice, it's so good to see you and Richard and Tina. It's wonderful. But Jared, I first got into this stockmanship business with Richard and Tina in Saskatoon. I think it was 2006. And at that point, the most significant thing for me was this business of releasing pressure, because I have all of my life been exerting way too much pressure.
Sure.
But it's interesting to now, we exert a lot of pressure on cattle now, but it's in a way that gets them to go where we want them to go. It's not, we're not forcing them, but we do use a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it's quite significant the way it works. At that same time that I met Richard and Tina, a guy there told me about this unique marketing system that Bud had. Now, Richard and Tina didn't say anything about it at that time, but this fellow told me about that, and it fascinated me. And I have been doing sell-by marketing now since 2006 or 7. And I went to school with Bud a couple of times, Richard and Tina and Bernhardt. Jared, you and I were at Doug Ferguson's school in November, December there. I've been to everybody's school, and I'm not going to any more, because if I don't know it now, I will never know it. But I can tell you that that has been the most significant business schooling that I have ever learned, has been sell by marketing. Just 2 weeks ago, we sold 560-pound steers and bought back 638-pound heifers and brought $150 a head home on the extra pounds. And that's just because we've learned to watch the market and see what the market is telling us, what is overvalued and what is undervalued.
Yeah.
And it's just so powerful. And the combination of both stockmanship and the marketing has been revolutionary. I've got a son at home now that I'm teaching this to, and this is going to go on, Eunice, a long time yet. Yeah, and I just want to express my gratefulness to you and Bud and Richard and Tina that you have been patient with me and helping me so much over the years. And I just want to thank you so much for that. But you know, the real challenge for me right now is keeping animals in the right frame of mind so that animal performance never suffers and the health of the animals stays absolutely the best it is. And you talk about the mind of the animal.
Yeah.
And you know, some people might think that's hocus pocus, but I'll tell you, if we can learn to control, I don't know whether it's control, but to get into the mind of the animal, to keep them stress-free so that their performance and their health just stays right at the top. And that to me right now is the challenge that I am attempting to learn to working with animals, because you know, the health of the animals and the individual animal performance is critical to our success and our businesses. So I'm going to keep working at it.
Good.
And hopefully the next generation will be so much superior to what I have been. So thank you again so much.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Well, Bud has always said that the lost performance that a rancher has no idea that he's losing far outweighs any death, loss, or health costs that you're putting into these animals. Yeah. If when we were at the feedlot there in Canada, if Bud saw sick animals in the alleys where the boys had made their pulls, he was not happy, and he said they should have been pulled the day before. The pulls that you make, they should not be looking sick. You're a day late on them. And I've seen him tell the boys to go, I want you to go in and pull 10 more calves out of that pen and to bring him out, because he getting behind. You know, you compare them by, you take the one out that looks the most droopy, you know, and pretty soon, you know, and if you get a day behind on them, and he was a, would doctor an animal sooner than anybody But he would, but he said that that's just the beginning of your job. You know, that why did he get sick? You go in and work with that pin, take him for a walk, do what's necessary to make sure that you're not going to have sick ones tomorrow too. So
thanks, Art. Yeah, neat to see Arts in Canada. Many of us from different parts of the world, but the principles don't know boundaries, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's right.
Yeah. Even the marketing principles, it's not currency dependent. It's not government dependent. And certainly the stockmanship principles work anywhere and even cross species, not just with cattle, right?
No, we work with reindeer. We've worked quite a lot with fallow deer. We've worked with elk. We've worked with hogs,
bison.
Bud didn't think, he said, don't try to encourage bison breeders to come. We have enough people, trouble teaching people to work cattle. But, you know, it's just like those darn animals. They said, well, gosh, I can see you're trying. You're not doing very good, but at least you're trying. So I'll try too. So
yeah, that's great.
It is.
So, Eunice, what would be your favorite story you'd like to share here kind of at the end? Anything that would pay tribute to your dear husband?
Oh, yeah, actually, my life and his life has been one long vacation. We never felt that we had to stay any place and do anything. If it wasn't fun, we moved on, did something that we did enjoy. We've met some of the nicest people, most wonderful people in the world. And you hate to, you know, you just have this compulsion to teach them what these things that are, they're so important and it'll make so much difference in their life and so much difference in the life of the livestock that they're handling. So,
well, that's, we appreciate the work that you've done. Richard and Tina, how, you know, your dad's not here, but how do people continue to learn? What are the resources that are out there that are available to learn both the stockmanship and the marketing side?
Well, Mom and I have put together, written up the things, you know, of course, her and Dad put the stockmanship videos together. We put the marketing book together with the stuff that Dad wrote. We got the stock dog video and book, put together the stuff he wrote on that. So each of the different things, we didn't talk much about stock dogs, but if you're interested, Mom loves talking about stock dogs. So, but we've got all this stuff on stockmanship.com of each of the things that kind of the different things that Dad did. And it's documented. It's really documented. Richard and I continue teaching the stockmanship and the marketing. Other people are teaching both. And so I think, and we've got a succession of my niece, I guess it's Mom's granddaughter, who will continue with the website and the books and all that, so that,
okay,
it will continue past us.
We do have, I did put together, I did self prepare a video of Bud starting a cult.
Oh, I forgot that one. Yeah.
You know, that's something Bud and I argued a lot about this, because I do actually have some pretty good video of starting a cult. And he said, no, I'm not. I don't want to get in a fight with horse trainers, you know, which he had enough problems with trial, stock dog trial people saying, and Bud saying, you know, that the trial type training is even detrimental to a range dog, but you certainly don't need to have a trial trained dog to be a good help to you, and the kind of thing with the horses. And just recently, well, we have had so many good friends really injured by horses in the last few years, and And honest to goodness, the way Bud starts a colt, they will not hurt you. Tina and I have always rode horses that we shouldn't. I mean, you know, because any time you get a colt going good, well, you either had to sell it or else you're working it for somebody else. And we have never been. The only time Bud ever got hurt with a horse was when the horses both front feet broke through a wooden culvert and it turned us. Sold on him, and right now we have two really good friends that are laid up from horse related injuries. So
was it the one fella, he called you and he was getting some other stuff, and you said you got the starting a colt, and he said I know every way there is of starting a colt. I've heard all there is to know about it. Did you send it to him free or did he decide to buy it?
No, he decided
to buy it. And he called her up later and said, you know, I hadn't seen every way to start a colt. it is all there. It's all.
But right during our schools, I used to argue with Bud right at schools, and I said, Bud, as soon as you die, I'm gonna make this video available.
Starting a cold.
It was kind of a dark humor thing, but you know, our whole life was kind of different than other people's.
Yeah. Well, I definitely would encourage you to check out. So it's stockmanship.com is the best way to be able to order books and videos and classes as well. Is that where you'd find out
ours,
about
ours it? Are linked from there. But oh, and we forgot Smile and Mean It. It's a 600 some odd pages. It's a big book. Well, I was showing how thick it was.
Oh yeah.
So too. it's the life story, and it, you know, the, you just heard a little touch tonight, but it's a pretty good,
good read, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I am so grateful that, you've compiled all that, because, that's a labor of love, and, yeah, it's going to serve generations to come. So thank you both. And
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, thank you, Eunice, for your time today. It's been a huge blessing to all of us who are on here live, and certainly to all those who will watch the recording. So at Ag Steward, this is the kind of thing that we do. We're all about education and helping people to be able to learn principles to be more profitable on their farms and ranches, to find more joy and fulfillment in life, and ultimately to do what Bud did, and that was to live the mission that he was put on this earth to live. And it might look unconventional to some people the way you go about doing that, but I would encourage you that is just your unique way to be able to express the gifts and talents that you've been given. And if it doesn't make sense to anybody else, it probably means you're on the right track. So.
Yeah.
Certainly, Bud was a contrarian. And we appreciate that, because if he'd have conformed, we wouldn't have what we have today. And so we are grateful that he was able to not only do the things, but also willing to teach the things that he did. So with that, I think we will go ahead and cut the recording, and then sometimes we stick around for just a few minutes afterwards. But thanks everybody for joining. Join us next time. We've got these every second and fourth Thursdays at 4 o'clock Pacific, and we're going to kind of keep up this cadence through this year. We've got folks lined up throughout the rest of the year, and so we hope you continue to join us.
Thanks for joining us on the Profitable Steward Podcast. Want to learn more about making your enterprise more profitable? Check out Ag Steward on our website, www.agsteward.fyi. Here at Ag Steward, we're working hard to make sure you have the latest tools and knowledge from the field of regenerative agriculture. Subscribe to our podcast to keep up with the latest info, and help us spread the word by giving this video a thumbs up, sharing this information with other farmers, and as always, please join the conversation by leaving us a rating and a review so we can help you to keep growing strong.